Hi, this is Ralph Zaransky. I'm on the phone with Perry Marshall. He is considered the king of AdWords, of working on Google and generating income for his clients, and has written many courses to teach people how to gain the same success that he has in minimizing the amount of investment that people make in pay-per-click advertising to maximize the gain. How are you doing today, Perry?
I'm doing great. It's good to be on.
Well, thanks. The reason why I chose you to be one of the heroes is just your honesty, your integrity, and just your desire to provide quality service and product above and beyond the call of duty. So maybe you could explain a little bit more in detail what it is that you do.
Well, in a bigger picture, I'm a direct marketer. I help people sell at a distance or sell through media, which that's become a more and more and more important thing compared to, you know, decades ago or a century ago. You know, before telephone and television and radio and everything, all selling had to be done face to face. Or, you know, before the post office, it had to be hand-delivered at best, you know, but technology has brought about a whole completely different way of people doing business with each other. So, of course, now you can stick up a website, and anybody in the world can access it, and with tools like Google, you know, you can pay them $5 and start advertising on their AdWords program, and people can find out about it almost instantly anywhere in the world. And so the communication tools that we have now are so incredibly powerful. It's really bewildering to people. So there's two aspects of that. And one is kind of the more technical aspect, which, you know, that's constantly changing, but it's also something that you can usually hire somebody to do for you for not a huge amount of money. But the other aspect of it is how do you actually communicate this to people? How do you persuade people? And so I started out, when I hung out my shingle 4 years ago, I left a job that I was working at, and I started consulting, for the most part, salespeople on how to not do cold calls anymore, how to advertise in such a way that people come to them instead of them chasing the customer. Later that year, Google AdWords came out, and I became intrigued with it real quickly. And about a year later, I started publishing courses on it. But basically, AdWords is Google's advertising system, where it's the right side of the page on a Google search where you see the little sponsored listings. And those ads are triggered by keywords, and the advertiser pays when a person clicks. And so that became a fascinating microcosm. And it's turned into a very, very important thing on the entire internet. I think it's about, I don't remember the exact numbers, but it's, you know, it's somewhere, it's a good, healthy, double-digit percentage of all internet advertising. And it's one of those things where you can lose your shirt if you don't know what you're doing, or you have enormous leverage if you do. So that's kind of a nutshell, it's an exciting time to be alive.
Yes, that's true. Well, you've met a lot of people on the internet at the different conferences, and I particularly was impressed with just your quality and just your style and just your integrity. And I was curious, what is your definition of heroism?
Of heroism? Well, I guess it's doing the right thing regardless of the consequences, which suggests that there are principles that are above and beyond the immediate concerns of safety or expediency. Usually the word hero refers to, like, you know, somebody saves somebody's life, or, you know, like Pearl Harbor, guys that helped other guys get out of the boat, and, you know, even though they got stuck there and drowned or whatever. Well, you know, that is what heroism is. And I think in today's business climate, there's there's a very pervasive culture in the marketing world that basically says whatever BS you have to make up to get the transaction done with is okay. And even a more subtle belief that, you know, truth itself is a very relative thing, and, you know, what's true for you is not true for me. And so what you end up with is you have a lot of people who really don't have any appreciation for the golden rule, or they don't really treat customers the way they would want to be treated. And you know, and it makes people cynical. It makes people mistrusting. And so now what every marketer has to overcome, I think the biggest factor that anybody in the marketing profession deals with, the most pervasive thing, is cynicism and distrust. Whenever it was 30 years ago, you know, you got all this stuff about Deep Throat in the news lately. Well, you know, 30 years ago, Richard Nixon lied to the American public, and everybody was just shocked, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And now, you know, you've got Bill Clinton lying about the Lewinsky thing. You've got the Bush administration obviously fabricating things to get us in the Iraqi war. And I'm not going to get into the politics of any of this, but I'm just going to comment that, you know, nobody's particularly shocked or surprised today that somebody's lying to them. And so, it creates this cynicism inflation in the world that it just becomes harder and harder to overcome. And if you make things up and couch them in very believable language in order to overcome somebody's skepticism, then when they find out the truth, all you've done is you've contributed to cynicism inflation, and you've made it harder for them to believe anything you say later. Now, on the other hand, if you are exceptionally truthful about things, your customers over time will discover that that is true of you, and they will believe you when they don't believe others. And so that's kind of a long answer to a short question, but I think it's really important, and it's interesting you're asking me all this stuff, because these topics rarely come up. Everybody wants to talk about tricks and techniques and clever ways of saying things and clever ways of getting internet traffic or, you know, whatever. But, you know, let's talk about, you know, some really simple things here. That's what we're talking about today.
Yeah, well, it's important to know who people are and what they actually believe. That's one of the reasons for the Heroes Program. The people that I'm interviewing is that people can learn a great deal when you hear the people that are trying to market you stuff answer questions that have real depth and meaning. And so the next question I wanted to ask you is, did you ever create a secret hero in your mind that helped you deal with life's difficulties?
That's a great question. It triggers all kinds of possible answers. I think everybody has, I don't know if the word is alter egos, sort of people you envision in your mind, like, well, what would this guy do, or what would that lady do, or whatever. I think, in the midst of all this chaos, it's kind of interesting that people wear a little armband that says WWJD, what would Jesus do?
Uh-huh.
Now, I think, you know, truth be told, the average person doesn't have a huge amount of knowledge about Jesus, but even people who are have only a passing familiarity with Jesus sort of somehow intuitively know that he was a guy that would not advocate violence, somebody who would advocate honesty, somebody who would sacrifice, who would be a hero, who would sacrifice the immediate safety or convenience for a larger purpose, which of course, you know, that's really what the whole Jesus story is about. And so, yeah, certainly for me, Jesus is in the forefront of my mind when I think about things like that. But, you know, I think there's other things too. You know, I was thinking not too long ago, my dad died about almost 20 years ago, but when I was a teenager, my parents went through a horrendous period in their marriage. My mom had a psychiatric disorder, and it caused her to behave very, very strangely. Anybody who's had like a person with a psychiatric problem living at home would relate to this.
Relate.
It can be very weird, very stressful.
Oh, scary sometimes.
And I remember me and my brother and sister, we're having this little powwow with Dad, and we're going, Dad, I think you should just take off. I think you should leave her and her silly perception of what's going on and go have a real life or something. And he steadfastly refused to do that. He said, nope. I stood up in front of a whole bunch of people and I promised, you know, God and everybody that I would stick to her till death do us part. And that's exactly what I'm going to do. Cause when you make a promise, you keep it. You know, when things like that happen at the time, it's like, well, okay, I guess mom and dad are going to, you know, grind through this, which, you know, more grind, you know, yee-haw. But later, much later, like when I got in college, I majored in electrical engineering, and it didn't take me too long to figure out that I was on a very, very steep learning curve. It was hard. And, you know, the first couple of years, the freshman and sophomore classes were weed-out classes where 40, 50, 60% of the class would fail, and you'd stay up all night long just trying to get a C, not to mention a B or an A. And on top of that, this was really rudimentary stuff, you know, it was calculus and all this, and I didn't really find much of it particularly interesting either. And I mean, really, it didn't get interesting till my junior and senior year. It was just a big grind, and I wanted to quit. But for some reason, I didn't. There was some part of me that would not give myself permission to go do something easier. Because deep down, I knew that I really belonged there. I really needed to master the stuff. And I needed to get the hard stuff out of the way so I could do the fun stuff later. But you had to master the basics before you could do the more creative things.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I think my dad's persistence in the face of adversity probably has a lot to do with me sticking it through. And today I'm very glad. Because now I am doing, really, what I was thinking at the time when I was in college is I'd much rather be majoring in English or something.
Mm-hmm.
Because that stuff came a lot easier to me than the math and the science did. I was very interested in math and science. I had some very specific reasons why I was there. But it just did not come as naturally to me as writing papers and all this kind of stuff, which I thought was a lot more fun.
Mm-hmm.
But I stuck with it. Well, now, you know, I don't spend most of my time doing math problems. I spend most of my time writing copy and you know, being a communicator and really operating in my talent zone. But one of the reasons that I'm good at what I do as an internet marketer is I develop the analytical side. And I'm very thankful today that I ground through all that stuff because, see, I can pick up a physics journal or an engineering journal or a math book or something like that, and I understand it. I understand what it's talking about, and you know, some of my marketing stuff gets me into more advanced mathematics, like the Taguchi method and stuff like that. And you know, it's really nice when you've got something under your belt and you've mastered it, and you don't use it every day, but when you do need to use it, it's there. You know, from a business perspective, it's something that differentiates me from others who do what I do, who maybe don't have that analytical capacity. And so, really, I mean, again, another long answer to a short question, you know, I think at the root of everybody's life is certain principles and values that you, you know, either believe in or don't believe in, ascribe to or don't. And they definitely affect everything else you do. But most people never directly see those, and most people never ask about them or talk about them, but they're there.
Yeah, well, I agree. You know, your dad gave you a great example of what true commitment and being a person of your word, which is so critical to have any integrity in the businesses that you're involved. And that seems to be one of the major considerations that I had when I chose people who I thought were heroes, were their integrity. Do you believe that there are certain principles that people should be willing to sacrifice their lives for?
Yeah, I do. The first thing, well, you know, it's interesting, it's very interesting you would ask me that question, because just last night my wife and I went to a play, and I think it was called Big Time. I don't remember the author. I'm sure it's kind of obscure, but what it was about, it was about this guy who works on Wall Street, and he's got the big office, and he works in the big company, and everybody kind of, well, the world bends to his will, because he's wealthy and powerful. It's like a 30-something, kind of a young, successful guy, right?
Uh-huh.
And all the characters in the play are kind of in this category, and they're all living this kind of shallow existence. And they're all kind of petty, and you know, he has these fights with his girlfriend and everything, and it kind of shows this pettiness, because like if he doesn't get his way, he's telling her she's a loser. Like he breaks up with his girlfriend finally, and or she decides that she is not sure about him and not sure they want to get married, and she tells him that, and he bursts out in this. This tirade about what a loser she is, and if she wasn't such a loser, she'd realize how important he is and how much he's helping her and all this kind of stuff. And you know, I'm watching this. It's like, you know, this is like, you know, proof positive that she shouldn't be with the guy.
Yeah.
And proof positive that he obviously doesn't love her at all, because if you love somebody, you don't call him a loser.
Yeah.
And treat him that way. Well, in the story, in this play, he has dealings with a minister of finance from some country in South America, and this country's in turmoil. And of course, it's a big deal, and there's a lot of money involved. And of course, the implication is this is all tainted money that was probably stolen from poor people, and it's all corrupt government slush fund stuff. But of course, he doesn't really care about that. But he goes down to this country. I think it's like Venezuela or something. And he goes down there to meet with this guy. And in the middle of his meeting, the government caves in.
Wow.
And one of the like rebels who helped overthrow the government, he kidnaps the guy, and so the guy is in this room, and the guy that kidnapped him is, you know, he's wearing this kind of military uniform and he's pacing back and forth, and you get this, you know, young businessman dude in his shirt and tie in some, you know, concrete cell in Venezuela. And the guy who kidnapped him actually went to school in the U.S. and is probably a lot smarter and more educated than most people would assume, okay? Yeah. And you know, this rebel, you know, had his reasons for being part of a group that overthrew the government, because the government was corrupt and they were oppressing people and all this kind of stuff. And the rebel asked the guy's name was Paul, he says, "Paul, I have a question for you." He says, "I'm fighting for my people, I'm fighting for freedom, I'm fighting for what I believe is right, and I'm willing to die for it." He says, "Is there anything you're willing to die for?" And he just stares back at him like he's speaking gibberish.
Mm-hmm.
And he repeats, he says, "Is there anything you would die for?" And he just looks at him again like, you know, you're kind of thinking, well, he came down here to do a financial deal.
Mm-hmm.
You know, what is his life really all about?
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, "I said, all I want to know is there anything you'd be willing to die for?" And he goes, "No." And that was like, I think that line was the point of the whole movie.
Mm-hmm.
That if there wasn't anything that you would die for, if there wasn't anything you'd sacrifice for, it's because you believe that you are the center of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And that everything is supposed to revolve around you. Which is why everybody in this play acts like the world revolves around them. Which is why nobody can get along with each other, because there's no sense of higher purpose, there's no sense of honor, there's no sense of decency, there's just me, 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 me. Okay? Mm-hmm. The only reason we live in a free country is because people paid with their lives believing that the freedom of their children, the future of their country was more important than they themselves were.
Boy, that's so true. That's so true. You know, I think that a lot of people don't ever get to that point where they think of what would I die for, or even a more important question, what would I live for, until they've experienced the lowest point in their life. What was the lowest point in your life, and how did you change your life path to win a victory over those obstacles?
That's a good question. Well, the first thing that I think of, I mean, everybody has different hard spots in their life, and they're always hard for different reasons, and a lot of times you can't really compare one to the other.
Mm-hmm.
But I remember when my dad died when I was 17, and that was about a 3-year process of fighting cancer and the emotional roller coaster. Dad's going to be okay. Dad's not going to be okay. Dad's going to be okay. Dad's, you know, all that stuff.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
I think,
do that now.
You know, most people by the time they're, you know, well into adulthood have probably experienced that with somebody.
Yeah.
You know, I remember being really upset about that. I remember having this conversation with my mom where I said, "Well, you know, I guess God gave me a dad, and if God's going to take my dad away, then God can do that." But then I think back a little later. This would have been about a month after my dad died. I was a senior in high school, and I was taking this class And we had this interesting assignment to write a philosophy of life. And by virtue of having been through the ringer with this, I had given those questions a lot more thought than probably most kids do at that age. And I hope I remember this correctly. I wrote down three things, and I turned this in. I said, nothing is worth living for unless it's worth dying for, because to live for something is to spend time which you cannot get back in pursuit of it.
Wow, that's pretty profound.
So that was the first thing, which, you know, none of this stuff, I didn't make up any of this stuff myself. I got it all from other people.
Mm-hmm.
But that was the first one. The second one was, I believe that the difficult things that you deal with in life will make you a stronger, better person, but only if you let them.
Mm-hmm.
That was the second one. The third one was a modification of, actually, I'm not completely sure where it comes from. I had read it in Henry David Thoreau, but I think it comes from the Westminster Confession. It said, I believe that the chief end of man is to glorify God and live with him forever.
Mm-hmm.
And so those three things, that was my philosophy of life at age 17, and
wow.
I'm not sure I would change that now. I think that was pretty good. Being forced to confront a lot of hard issues, I think that's the only way you really kind of figure out what's important and what's not.
Uh-huh.
So
it's really, really important to have a positive view of setbacks, misfortunes, and mistakes.
It's very important. I mean, it's really one of these deals where you can have it either way. And which way do you want it? I mean, do you want to look at your tragedy in life like life sucks, then you die, it's all meaningless? I mean, there are a lot of people that do.
Yeah.
There's a lot of people, they look at life exactly that way. And they actually resent people who don't.
No, I agree.
I can't remember exactly how this quote goes, but it's something like, people who dance are considered crazy by those who can't hear the music.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's really kind of like that. It's like, is tragedy just tragedy? Is that all that it is? Or is there music somewhere?
Mm-hmm.
Is there purpose going on somewhere? And so, you know, this really gets into the whole, you know, the deepest aspects of what your philosophy of life really is.
Mm-hmm.
These are all very religious questions.
Yeah.
I think, you know, we have this sort of taboo in Western society that, you know, you're not really supposed to discuss all that kind of stuff.
Yeah.
But, you know, the fact is, everybody's going to have to wrestle with it sometime or another, and when they do, they're either going to be equipped to deal with it because they've been discussing it, mm-hmm. or it's going to blindside them and they're going to be forced into this whole new train of thought that, mm-hmm. you know, they never learned about in school, they never, you know, nobody was supposed to talk about in a polite company,
yeah.
and they end up going through it alone, which, you know, doesn't that make a person all the more cynical, you know, if they think that, you know,
yeah.
life sucks, then you die. So,
Well, do you think that it's important to have a dream or vision that sets the course of your life?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. When you talk about dreams and visions and stuff, sometimes I think you can sort of trivialize it like, what's your dream? Well, my dream is to drive a Mercedes,
mm-hmm.
or some such thing. Well, I hope your dream for your life is bigger than that. And I don't mean more expensive either. I mean more substantive. But, mm-hmm. even in the mundane sense, it always helps if you know what you're working for.
Mm-hmm.
And when I was a kid, it always helped if I knew why I was doing the paper route.
Yeah.
It never was enough to just, I'm saving up some money for someday.
Yeah, yeah. Well, do you think that it takes courage to pursue new ideas? It seems that in everybody's lives, everybody's comfortable with the way that you are, and if you start changing, then all of a sudden they either have to reject you or they have to change also.
Well, courage is really the king of all virtues. If you said, what are the greatest virtues? You could talk about love and honor and trust and all this kind of stuff, but none of those things really have any dimension to them unless you have the courage to pursue them. And it always takes courage to do it. You're always at odds with most of the rest of the world when you embrace virtue.
Mm-hmm.
It's always easier to fudge a little bit. It's always easier to make it up. It's all, I'm certainly not saying I'm perfect in any of those regards, but, what I can be is aware, or if somebody calls it to my attention, hey, you said you would do this, but you never did.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then I need to, you're right. Let's fix that.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, one thing that everybody experiences, I don't think there's anybody that does not, is doubts and fears. A lot of people fear injury, they fear failure, they feel rejection. Some people even fear success. How do you overcome your doubts and fears?
Well, it's a funny thing, I've kind of figured out over a long period of time that when I feel trepidation about something I'm planning to do, it's usually because it's important. You usually don't feel fear about doing trivial things. Sometimes people don't even feel fear about, getting on a motorcycle and going 100 miles an hour.
Mm-hmm.
How could I put this? I know somebody who got in a very compromising sexual situation with somebody, and it happened years ago, and it was just kind of sitting there, simmering under the surface. Nobody knew about it. She was having to deal with this all the time, but it was too taboo to really bring up.
Mm-hmm.
And finally, she was talking to my wife and I about this, and we said, you know what? You need to talk to the other person about it, and you need to confront them about what happened. This was, this is something you'd categorize as abusive, okay?
Yeah.
She being the victim, and, she was afraid of wrecking the other person's life,
mm-hmm.
which, if you think about it, there is something kind of honorable about that, because even though the other person had hurt her very deeply,
mm-hmm.
She was still concerned for his well-being.
Mm-hmm.
And it was like, you know what? You cannot keep trying to sweep this under the rug.
Mm-hmm.
it will not get better until you deal with it. Well, eventually she did, and it took an enormous amount of courage to bring it up, but that opened the door to making the situation something they could deal with.
Uh-huh.
And to begin to solve the problem. Mm-hmm. And you know, things like that are really scary.
Yeah.
But again, the fact that it is scary tells you that it needs to be done.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, you know, whatever it might be, and you know, a lot of times it's things that are a whole lot less onerous than that. You know, it takes courage to go take out a small business loan and hang out your shingle.
Mm-hmm.
You know that the odds are stacked against you.
Yeah.
You know you could fail. One of the things I learned when I was in my 20s was, you know, if I fail, if I get rejection, if people say no, if they don't take me up on my proposal, if I get an F in a class and have to retake it over,
mm-hmm.
guess what? It's not the end of the world.
Isn't that true?
Life did not come to a screeching halt when I flunked this test.
Yeah.
Life did not grind to a screeching halt when I flunked the class and had to retake it over. And it didn't make me a bad person. It just means I didn't make it that time.
Yeah.
And so really successful people of any stripe learn to look at failure as it's a corrective force in your life. It's something that it's something that kind of shakes the slag and the garbage off of you and weeds out the trivial stuff and focuses you on what's important, and you know, eventually you figure out the formula.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting that you would say that and tell that story about that lady, because there's always a question as far as the importance of forgiveness of those who upset, offend, and oppose us. And on the opposite side of that, there's accountability, people that do offend us. Where do you think is the balance between having people be accountable for the bad things that they do or the wrong things and actually forgiving them for the things that they did to you personally?
Well, that's a really great question. And I think it's important. It's more important than it might sound on the surface, because every one of us has people that we have forgiveness issues with. Okay? Every one of us has done things to other people that that were wrong, and that we need to be forgiven for. But you know, that doesn't really help very much until we realize that that is the case. You know, you can't just live in denial that, you know, you've gone your whole life and, you know, as though you've never ever hurt anybody or never done anybody wrong, because all of us have.
Yeah.
And on the other side, all of us have little grudges, or sometimes big grudges, that we hold against other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think you can be healthy when you're walking around with that. I think it's impossible. I think if the truth be known, you know, everybody talks about, well, you know, does this, you know, if you eat peanut butter and the peanut butter had the peanuts had insecticide on them or something, are you going to get cancer, or does this cause cancer, does that cause cancer, or whatever? You know, I'd be willing to bet you every penny I've got that things like anger and grudges and stuff like that cause more diseases and more, you know, mental health problems and more things that cost us all time and money.
Mm-hmm.
than any of those other things.
Oh, that's true.
You know, or like I got a friend who's a minister. He likes to say, you know, there's a lot of churches where, you know, some, you know, the pastor or whoever running the church, he'd be, you know, if they caught him smoking a cigarette, they'd throw him out in a heartbeat.
Uh-huh.
You know, like, oh, that's really evil. You know, if you smoke cigarettes, you're really bad. But, like, you know, he bickers with people, and he fights with people, and he spreads rumors about people, and he has these little fiefdoms and wars, and they never throw him out for that. You know, it's like, which is really worse?
Uh-huh.
I'd rather live with a smoker who's at peace with themselves than a non-smoker who's contentious. How about you?
Oh, I agree.
You know, so there's all these things that are like, they're all surface level.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, everybody's got to deal with that stuff. And I think, you know, if you say, is there anybody you need to forgive? All of us can think of somebody that we need to, that we only partially did, or maybe we didn't at all. Or we're still swearing we're going to get even with them. You know,
yeah.
You just got to let go of that. Now, this came up in a discussion. I interviewed one of my customers, and he told a really interesting story. He had a guy who was, he worked at some company that was one of his vendors, and he kind of knew this guy, but not very well, and the guy kind of disappeared. Like, you know, you just sort of assume that, you know, that he got a different job or something. Well, it turns out what actually happened was he molested a child or something like that. He was a sex offender.
Wow.
And he went to jail. Mm-hmm. And he was in jail for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then they let him out. And he had a probation officer, and he had this this thing around his leg.
Uh-huh.
Where, like, he's got to come to the office and plug it in, and like, it's so the probation officer knows where this guy is 24/7. He's under constant surveillance, basically.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, okay, you got 20 minutes to drive home. Then you got to go home and plug the thing in.
Wow.
You know, you got an hour and a half on Saturday afternoon to go to the bank and go grocery shopping, and then you got to be home. You know, like, just like that, right?
Yeah.
Well, so he comes to see John one day, and he says, hey, John, and he kind of tells him his story. You know, I knew you way back when, and I was working at this company, and then I got in trouble, and I lost my family, my wife divorced me, I lost my job, I went to jail, my entire life fell apart. John, would you give me a job?
Mm-hmm.
Ooh. Ooh. Well, John hired him. John gave him a job. Then John got to know the probation officer, and he ended up hiring another guy, too.
Mm-hmm.
Now he's got two of these guys working in his company.
Wow.
And you know, John was raving about this guy because he said, these guys, they always show up on time. Every single day.
Uh-huh.
They work very hard. I do not have to pay them as much as I would have to pay other people, because frankly they can't get a job anywhere else, and they're thankful for what they got.
Yeah.
And he says they'll run through walls for me because they're so appreciative of me giving them a chance. If I give them a problem to solve, they figure out how to solve it. These guys are great employees.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And, like, you know, this is a strategy for finding an employee. Now, obviously, John does not run a daycare.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there aren't any kids or anything that work there, so that's not an issue. But this was a strategy for, you know, getting an employee, and we all know that good employees are hard to find. You know, good work ethic and everything, it's not easy. So, so I interviewed John, and John told this whole story on one of my CDs, and it went out to my subscribers, and, you know, I got this angry email from this guy, and he goes, I can't believe that you're advocating that we take these criminals and give them a job and all this kind of stuff. And I said, well, I said, I can only give you my opinion. I said, first of all, you know, the information you get from me, it's a cafeteria, and you can take it or leave it. Not every idea applies to you, you know, but I said, here's how I look at this. I said, these guys did go to jail, and as far as society is concerned, you know, we live in a democracy, we have laws, the laws got there by a democratic process, and our society has decided that they paid the price they're supposed to pay. Mm-hmm. And these guys are still under probation, and I said, you know, the Lord's Prayer says, forgive others as we forgive those who do bad things to us.
Uh-huh.
I said, my obligation, if a person has, you know, done their penance to society, and if they want to be forgiven, my obligation is to forgive them.
How true is that?
Doesn't mean that I have them run my daycare,
yeah,
or that I do anything stupid like that.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, there, it's a two-sided coin, because all of us have bones in our closet. All of us have things we're not ashamed of. And we all hope that other people will give us some slack.
Yeah.
And so we have to give other people slack, too. It doesn't mean you be stupid.
Yeah.
You know, I had a tenant steal from me. Okay, well, we evicted her. You know, and she was sorry, and she apologized, and she cried, and all that stuff. And we said, well, we forgive you, and you need to find a new place to live.
Mm-hmm.
Because I did not think it was appropriate to not have a consequence.
Mm-hmm.
She needed to learn. Like, it took us a while to figure it out. It had become a pattern,
mm-hmm,
which almost always there is.
Yeah.
You know, there's never just one cockroach.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, you know, just because you forgive somebody doesn't mean there's not consequences. But, you know, I'm not sitting here. Well, I did forgive her. I'm not angry at her or, you know, she never actually even paid us back. Well, you know, I'm not going to go after her. That's just going to be unnecessary time and money and headache, you know. So,
that's again, always the question that people end up facing is that, it's easy to forgive somebody, you know, if they offended us or stole from us or other. The harder part is to call them to accountability and make sure that they realize that there are consequences for their wrong actions.
Right. And there are consequences. And, you know, consequences are the only way people ever learn to straighten themselves out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if somebody's coming to work drunk every day, you better make sure there's some consequences, because the problem ain't going to solve itself.
Yeah.
That's for sure.
Yeah.
You know, so a lot of times the most loving thing you can do with somebody is have a harsh consequence.
Yeah, yeah.
And that's just, that's the reality of living in a imperfect world.
I think that's probably the true definition of love, is when somebody's going down the wrong path, to actually try and steer them to a better path, or just show them, or try to help them find a better path.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I remember, you remember Jerry Garcia?
Sure.
The guitarist for the Grateful Dead. I listened to an interview with his drummer, Mickey Hart, the drummer for the Grateful Dead. And some guy called in, it was like on a radio show, and some guy called in and he says, hey, how come you didn't keep Jerry from overdosing on drugs? And he goes, dude, have you ever had a friend who had a drug problem? Have you ever tried to get him to stop? It's not like we didn't try.
Yeah.
It's like Jerry did what Jerry was going to do.
Mm.
You know, who knows what they did to try to stop it.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
But obviously it didn't work.
Sure.
Obviously the consequences at some point along the way were not bad enough.
Yeah.
And if the consequences had been worse when it was a less onerous problem,
mm-hmm,
Jerry Garcia would still be alive and he'd still be doing Grateful Dead concerts, you know?
Okay.
So what can you say?
Yeah, well, you can just do your best and just leave it in God's hands, because there's only so far that you can go. and realize that when you try to help people that are going down the wrong path, the first thing they're going to do is hate you and blame you, and it takes a tremendous love for that person to be willing to accept their anger and accept that abuse.
Yes, and you know, I'll even go further and I'll say that most people with a big problem blame the problem on the solution.
Can you explain that?
Well, this is kind of hypothetical, but you know, if some guy's got an alcohol problem and his wife tells him he needs to get help, he's probably going to tell her that the reason he drinks is because of her.
That's true. Yep.
You know?
Blame, yep.
And it's like, the truth is, she's the one that loves him the most of anybody in the world,
mm-hmm.
which is exactly why she's telling them to get help.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and because she's telling him and nobody else is, he's mad at her.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he might be really, really, really angry at her, you know.
He'll be.
And really, if you're not willing to deal with the consequences, what can you blame?
Yeah.
But the solution.
Boy, isn't that the truth? Yeah, well, we've all been there.
Yeah.
You know, and I think that the answer and one of the big solutions is just serving others. And do you experience service to others as a source of joy?
Yes. Absolutely.